You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2023 Giro d'Italia. Today we are in Ortona.
Brian, il Barone, you've already got a nickname one day into the Giro d'Italia, the Baron. Where are we?
Well, first of all, thank you for that. Unexpected. Yeah, we're sitting looking at a fantastic landscape outside the tasting room of the winery Ifauri, where we're lucky to be lodging.
One wine token. We should really say who we are and what we are. We're the Cycling Podcast. We're at the Giro d'Italia. This is Girovagando. You've already heard that in the intro, haven't you? Brian, we are at the Tenuta Ifauri.
Drinking actually.
One stage down. Yeah, we're drinking a glass of Pecorino, lovely glass of Pecorino. We might even film a bit of this podcast, so people might even be able to see the beautiful scene. Describe the scene for those who won't see.
Well, we're looking at a very sort of rolling hills, high mountains in the background, snow-capped. And we're looking at these beautiful vineyards, very well-maintained, biological. And we're drinking wine from, basically we can look at the vines from where we're sitting. And
lovely Pecorino. Pecorino, which most people will know what Pecorino, well, they'll know the cheese.
Yeah, we're not drinking any cheese.
We're not drinking cheese. That might be later. Pecorino is so called because pecora is sheep in Italian. And the theory goes that the bunches of Pecorino grapes look like a sheep's head.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brian, we can also see to the other, if we look the other way, we can see the Maiella, very famous mountain massif in this part of the world where Blockhouse is. Blockhouse doesn't feature on the Giro d'Italia. Absolutely covered in snow, isn't it? Looks like it's been dunked in snow. But Brian, we've seen a first stage of the Giro d'Italia. Well, that has delivered, I wouldn't say pretty emphatic verdicts on where everyone is at. Certainly starting this Giro d'Italia. I can see you getting nervous already because you know I'm about to. We've dispensed with the, what did we call it last year? The Stay Summary Time Trial, the deeply unpopular Stay Summary Time Trial. The Tale of the Tapper is back. And you, Brian Nygaard, well, you are on the start ramp.
It's time for the Tale of the Tapper.
Brian, take it away.
Thank you. And also, I think I need to say we're recording with a live audience. There's like six or eight cats.
Yes, this brings back memories. Dario Cataldo and Mattia Cattaneo, famous podcast incident 3 or 4 years ago on Lago di Zeo. Dario Cataldo, who's from Abruzzo, he was at the finish today. He had a terrible crash earlier in the season. He's recovering. But yeah, we are surrounded by cats.
Surrounded by cats, a glass of wine. What more can you ask?
We haven't fed the cats. For anyone who doesn't remember that infamous incident, we haven't fed the cats any crisps. We got in trouble for that a couple of years ago. Tale of the Tapper.
Here we are. So stage one of the 2023 Giro d'Italia started with a individual time trial of 19.6 kilometers from the Fossa Cesia Marina to Ortona. Around 13 kilometers of that time trial was on a ciclovia Costa dei Trabocchi. So it's a bike path beautifully laid out along the Adriatic coast, the riders took the start in beautiful weather, no winds, and it was Lorenz Huis from Intermarché who opened the Giro. And actually, interestingly enough, the last rider on the ramp was Stefano Oldani. So the three big riders everyone were looking to see and measure up against each other, especially for the TT, but also for the GC, they were starting right basically next to each other. So Evenepoel, Roglic and Ganna were almost at the last part. The parcours for the time trial was quite interesting because it was pancake flat until they swerved away from the ciclovia and up to a small climb, small but significant, I would say, for a time trial like this, to the town of Ortona. And it's not what decided the time trial, but it gave us a pretty good indication, like you said, of who is really up for it from the start of this Giro. I would say no surprises in the result as such, but a small surprise, I would say, measurable difference between Roglic and Evenepoel. So Evenepoel was the fastest today, significantly fastest, winning the TT and getting the pink jersey, 22 seconds ahead of Philipp Bugarner, 29 seconds ahead of João Almeida. Fourth place, Tao Gegenhardt, 40 seconds down. But, and this is probably the most significant news of the day, is Roglic finishing 43 seconds down on what everyone, at least until now, and I think probably also should think of his biggest rival, Remco Evenepoel, for the overall win of this Giro.
Any other notable performances, Brian? Geraint Thomas, where was he?
Geraint Thomas was ninth, 55 seconds down. The team's sort of overall best result in the top 10 is UAE Emirates. They have Almeida, Jayvine, and McNulty within the first eight riders today.
Quite an easy, if I may say so, quite an easy teletubber to do the first one, isn't it? Because you don't have to get too into the weeds about the minor classifications. Although the mountains classification was quite interesting. There was, this was one of those time trials finishing with a climb. We did wonder whether there might be riders who specifically targeted only that jersey, or whether the winner of the stage and the guy who ultimately went fastest was going to be the fastest on the climb. What happened, Brian?
Yeah, I was quite convinced that actually the mountain jersey would also go to Evenepoel, but it didn't. The fastest on the, I think it was a 1.9 kilometer measurement of that, including the climb up to the finish, was actually McNulty, Brandon McNulty of UAE. Second was Tao Gegenhardt and João Almeida. And when I looked at the intermediates, they still haven't been corrected, so they're unofficial. But Roglic and Evenepoel were basically within a second of each other on the last climb. So the time that he took out of Roglic, Evenepoel today, was on the flat.
Primoz Roglic, who arrived back at the Jumbo-Visma, it wasn't the team bus, it was the camper van, which was parked just to the back of the press room. I was there. He'd sort of given everyone else the slip on the finish line, and he came straight back to the camper, and I was there. Our friend David from Slovenian TV was there, but not many others were there. And he was in sort of boisterous mood, as Primoz Roglic often is these days. When he came back, he sort of smiled at us and, it hurt, But he was very happy with the fact that he sounded happy that with his average speed, which seemed a bit strange to me because I think he said, 50k an hour, not bad. But that is pretty standard, isn't it, for a Primoz Roglic time trial. However, he was certainly talking a good game, appearing very relaxed. As I say, this is Primoz Roglic's modus operandi these days. He almost seemed too relaxed, as though it was a deflection technique. You're going to hear in a minute his interview, the interview he gave me and NOS and a couple of NOS is the Dutch broadcaster here and a couple of other people, when he was warming down. But he's also going to, we'll touch on the difficult few days that his team have had, because of course they have been, as much as Remco Evenepoel today, Jumbo-Visma's tumultuous build-up to this race has been the story of the Giro so far. Brian, can you even remember how many changes they've made?
It's been a game of musical chairs. So it's not been easy for their planning, and it's certainly not been easy for the riders getting the late call up to go to this Giro. So they've had to change. Even they had to put a reserve in for a reserve. So someone they put in instead of a COVID positive actually had to leave as well.
So let's run through them. Tobias Foss, he was the first to go with Robert Hasink. They were replaced by Jos van Emden and Sam Omen. Then van Emden, he had to pull out because of a COVID positive as well. And then yesterday, they lost Jan Tratnik because he crashed on a training ride somewhere near the time trial course today. And, they had to call up their British near pro Thomas Gloke, who we knew had been at this training camp in, where were they? They were in Tenerife, weren't they? We knew he'd been there, and there was talk a few weeks ago that he was on a sort of long list, or he was the third or fourth reserve for the Giro d'Italia. And the circumstances in which he was given that call, or he got that call yesterday, were themselves a little bit, it was certainly an eventful day for Thomas Gloke. We're going to hear from him when he finished his time trial in just a second. But first, let's hear from Primoz Roglic and then Thomas Gloke.
Primoz, what can you say about your time trial?
I'm happy about that. Although I don't know completely the results, but for my feeling or what I did was nice. I'm happy.
You came fifth, 43 seconds behind Evenepoel.
For sure you want to be in front, but it's fine. I mean, I did my best and up to the next stages.
Yeah, so what does it say about Evenepoel if you feel fine and he's 43 seconds faster?
He was obviously faster today. Huh?
Yeah, and what does that mean? Does it impress you?
No, not really. I mean, he's 20 days to go. And yeah, the fastest and the strongest one at the end will win. I didn't hope for nothing. I mean, like I said, for sure you want to be in front. But on the other hand, I'm also not 3 minutes behind. So I'm happy.
A lot of things happened this week in your team. Your freshest teammate, the last change, flew in on 3:30 this morning. He arrived in the hotel. Did it cause stress also with you?
I mean, it's not ideal, and therefore it's not something that you would wish for, but we deal with it. We start with eight today, and we go on with
it. Do you feel close to your best at the moment, physically?
I did a good time trial, and like I said, we see day by day, week by week, how it will go.
Yeah, so I did a... I was planning on going up to Andorra. I got on a training camp with my girlfriend, just for some time away training for this next block of racing that I had. And I did, I had some time off after Romandy, and I came back after 4 hours, and I leave my phone on with the data off, and I came back and was like, oh, I have about 50 missed notifications from every man and his dog on the team. So I was like, oh dear, this is not good. I pick up the phone to Grisha, and he said, I'll keep classic Dutch. Oh, he's German actually, but you know, Dutch mentality. I'll keep it short. You're going to the Giro. I said, okay then. And that was basically, well, the final call was made around 5, and yeah, I was packing my bags, my bikes, because you know there were no bikes. It wasn't expected that I'd come here, and got to the airport, and yeah, I arrived in at half three in the morning. So that was an eventful. It's been under 24 hours since I got the call. So. Yeah.
How did you feel now in the time trial and everything?
Yeah, it was like warming up. I felt good, and then I was sitting on a plane for so long and in the car that I got on and my glutes were really stiff. You know, I was just fighting the bike anyway. And to be honest, it's not the most pretty of disciplines to ride in the first place. So I never look very pretty on a time trial bike, and especially today I didn't. But I'm really looking forward to riding into the race, and what an opportunity! You know, the fact that I can say that I'm able to ride a Giro d'Italia is extremely special.
Thomas, what have the team said they want from you or expect from you?
Yeah, good question. I haven't really spoken to them, to be honest. I think it's one of those situations where obviously Tratnik was a huge integral part of the team, and for that to happen to him right at the last, you know, it's extremely unfortunate. He spent months at altitude this year preparing for this one race. The whole first half of the season was really built coming into this. So yeah, he's obviously a massively integral part of the team, and look, I've obviously got a decent shape at Romandy, so I think it's kind of like expect the worst, hope for the best. So we'll see.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast Giro d'Italia coverage, our Stage 1 episode, is sponsored by GCN Plus. All of our listeners in the UK can get 15% off an annual GCN Plus subscription just in time for the first Grand Tour of the season. Go to gcn.eu/cycling15, that's cycling15, to subscribe. GCN Plus is how I'm watching the race this year, and I won't miss a single important moment because the whole race is live and uninterrupted. And if you can't watch the stages live, you can watch full replays on demand if you wish. But if you haven't got the time for that, then you can pick from the highlights packages. There's highlights packages of various lengths depending on the time you have available. And one of the features that I really like on GCN Plus is that you can pause and rewind the racing. So if there is a controversial incident and you didn't quite see what had happened, you can rewind and watch it again. But really, the thing that sets GCN apart is the commentary and presentation team. Friend of the podcast, Rob Hatch and Sean Kelly in the commentary box, of course, joined by Dan Lloyd, Robbie McEwen and Adam Blythe. And then the breakaway, their analysis of the race, all held together brilliantly by Orla Shenoui, co-host of the cycling podcast Feminin, of course. The GCN app is also your essential companion for the Giro d'Italia because it's got all the information you need about the stages, race previews, route maps and profiles, and start lists. And of course, GCN will also be covering any other racing that's going on while the Giro has the majority of our attention. And if that's not enough, there is also an archive of excellent cycling films that you can watch anytime. And an annual subscription is really about the price of a cup of coffee a month. So go to gcn.eu/cycling15 to subscribe.
Well, Brian, we've heard a little bit about what happened before today from Thomas Gloag there, a fantastic account he gave. And we've heard a little bit about what happened in the time trial. But let's wind the clock back to earlier today. I can't remember whether it was. It was shortly after 11 o'clock. And I dialed the number of our good friend, our absent friend here on the ground in Italy, but very much present. He's going to be present every day in the podcast.
It's past 11. Time for my cappuccino break.
La pausa cappuccino con Lionel Burney. Dopo le 11.
Pronto. Is that Lionel? Lionel Burney?
Hello, Daniel. Look, you've interrupted the King's coronation here, King Charles III. I mean, there's even a Giro link here because the throne he's sitting on at the moment, it's been inspired by the Giro's Maglia Rosa because it's a very fetching pink colour. It's extraordinary.
Wow. Lionel, do you know what? I would actually give anything for a post 11 o'clock cappuccino right now because I have not stopped this morning. As you can imagine, there have been a few cock-ups already. The Baron Nygaard got his baptism of fire. My phone wasn't working, so he had to do the navigation. He took us to the permanence, their headquarters for yesterday. So we ended 30 kilometres out of the way. So it's not been very fruitful so far. It's a quintessential sort of Giro scene that I'm surveying at the moment. I'm in the press room, which is in a volleyball hall, of course. That, you know, 50% of stages at the Giro, the press room's in a volleyball hall. And Stefano Di Cete, who is the long-serving, much-loved press chief of the Giro, is sort of stomping furiously up and down. And I asked him why he looked so unsettled and disconcerted earlier, and he said that he's been given official sort of Giro issue trousers that have no pockets in, and his sweatshirt, his Giro Felpa sweatshirt, also has no pockets in, so he can't he's got nowhere to put his keys, he's got nowhere to put anything. This is causing great consternation. Anyway, Lionel, man, how are you?
This sounds like the sort of thing that might bring the whole Giro d'Italia to a halt. You know, I can imagine the hand gestures. Yes. Already. Here in the UK, Giro fever building, obviously, but we've got to get the coronation of King Charles III out of the way first. I did notice on the start list there is one Charles in the race, Charlie Quarterman, riding for Team Coratec. And there's even a Giro link there, you know, because he started out his career as a very young man riding for Flavio Zappi's development team, which is based in Oxfordshire in the UK. And Zappi himself was second in the Giro King of the Mountains competition in 1984, second to Laurent Fignon, and wore the leader's jersey for a few days as well. But as you say, the closest we've got to royalty on the cycling podcast is Baron Brian Nygaard, Il Barone. But if you've had a bad morning or a difficult morning, a logistically challenging morning, it's nothing compared to Jumbo Visma's build-up to the Giro, is it? I mean, we thought after recording the extra-large Giro preview that their woes were over with replacing a couple of riders, but then Jos van Emden, who was one of the replacements, then had to be replaced. Tom Gloag's now come in, as we've just heard, and I mean, their kind of preparation is not ideal, is it? It's going to affect the team, surely. It's going to unsettle Roglic, or is he totally unflappable these days?
My main concern, do you know what it was? And this is, I'm being facetious here. I mean, we're very sorry for Jan Tratnik, and I'm also disappointed that he's not here because he's also a great guy to talk to, and you know, he's a great guy to watch ride. However, I must admit one of my concerns is that his agent, who is also Primoz Roglic's agent, well, who is also my dealer of a very difficult to come by Swiss soft drink, has got the consignment because he promised me that he was bringing two crates of blue Rivella, and he even sent me a picture a couple of days ago of the boot of his car loaded up with the Rivella. So I'm hoping that the delivery hasn't been derailed.
Wow.
But the team itself, I mean, Brian and I, we will talk about this, I'm sure, over the next few days, but the team itself on paper, it may not be that badly weakened, apart from Tratnik obviously being replaced by a Neopro. Very promising Neopro, strong Neopro, but Tratnik is, he's three riders in one, isn't he? And Rowan Dennis, to be fair, can be three riders in one when he's at his best. But we don't really know, and we're going to find out over the next few days how well prepared these subs are, effectively.
Moving on, Daniel, the other last-minute change before the Giro d'Italia was, as expected, the EF Education Easy Post jersey. They ride in a predominantly pink jersey the rest of the season, so to avoid a clash with the Giro's pink jersey, they have switched. I have to say, the new design would not look out of place at the King's coronation. A real mix of colours, half yellow, half pink.
A bit orangey to me.
What, from a distance, you mean? Yeah, possibly.
Yeah, the pink looks slightly orangey for me.
I like the half and half, Lionel. I must admit. I mean, it echoes of Blackburn Rovers Football Club, which would please Rob Hatch. Our good friend Rob Hatch is a Blackburn fan. But there's not enough striped tight jerseys in the peloton, so this is a big step forward for me.
Lionel, final piece of news that's been breaking this morning, I think, has been about the penultimate day time trial, the Monte Lussari time trial, the very steep uphill time trial we got on the penultimate day. You've got some news, haven't you?
Well, yeah, this is leaking out over the last 24 hours. It's all the way at the other end of the race, of course, so plenty of time for the Giro's organisers, the UCI, the teams, to thrash out some sort of solution. But the climb is a very narrow path and cars won't be able to go up, so the proposal is for the mechanics to go on the back of motorbikes carrying their spares, whether that's wheels or complete spare bikes, not entirely sure. But there are understandably some doubts about whether this is practical. Also some concerns about how everyone would get off the mountain afterwards. And so the climb itself is in doubt, which would be a shame because it looks like a really tough athletic challenge, but it may well be that the logistical challenge is too much for the Giro organisers to overcome. But as I say, best part of 3 weeks for them to sort that out.
Lionel, I will endeavour over the next day or two to speak to friend of the podcast, Alessandro De Marchi, who is here riding for Jayco Alula, and he is from that neck of the woods, and I know that he also did a recon of Monte Lussari just a couple of weeks ago, so we'll get his verdict as well. Lionel, I think that's about it for La Pausa Cappuccino today. We'll check in with you again tomorrow.
Excellent. Well, enjoy it, and keep an eye on the wine list when Brian's doing the ordering later, please.
Oh, that's a different Pausa. That's a different subject altogether. Well, Brian, we finished our call there, more or less talking about the Monte Lussari. We went way ahead to the end of the Giro, and Rai TV also did this today. Italian TV also did this. They spent an inordinate amount of time talking about the snow in Switzerland in 2 weeks. Let's not look beyond tomorrow. Let's take every day, every stage that comes.
You sound a bit like Roglic now.
I do, you know what I mean, huh? But let's not think too much about Monte Lussari and the penultimate day of the Giro. However, since I did mention it, and I said that we would speak to Alessandro De Marchi, who has done a recon of the climb, I did see him actually after his time trial today, and I did ask him what he made of these sort of swirling rumours about Monte Lussari and whether it was passable and whether it was safe or not.
It's just a typical Giro climb, steep, not so wide, but they make the road new, so the surface is okay. I mean, there is no problem of safety. There is no problem, I think, for the assistant during the TT. With the moto, I think the everything would be fine.
Brian, back to today, back to this afternoon, stage one of the Giro d'Italia, and I called it in the intro, an emphatic verdict that was delivered by today's stage. You can't really describe it any other way, can you, an emphatic shot across everyone's bowels from Remco Evenepoel.
He blew off the door, basically, coming into this Giro. Road, probably one of the most perfect time trials you could possibly do on this parcours, and he made a very clear statement about where he is and what he wants to do here. He was a clear favorite, and I think also the significance of this result would and should always be measured to whereas Roglic in this, whereas his other competitors, no one was surprised that he would win. It was just a question of how much time he would take out.
Yeah. Loyal listeners will remember that I predicted this a couple of weeks ago. I thought that Filippo Ganna wouldn't win and that he would be beaten today by Remco Evenepoel. Yeah, we've talked quite a bit. We talked in our preview, didn't we, about these, you know, the sort of noise around and the hype around Remco's preparation. And, well, we saw at Liège-Bastogne-Liège how well he's going. So I wasn't really surprised. I mean, there was a lot of talk today at the finish, just talking to various people on teams and other journalists, you know, who do you think is going to win the Giro? And in my mind, it's sort of a three-way split between an even split between Remco, Roglic, and someone else. That's sort of how I'm thinking about this Giro. However, if someone was to say to me, one rider will dominate this Giro d'Italia, I wouldn't hesitate to say that it would be Remco Evenepoel. I think we all feel that there is that potential here for this to be not Remco's sort of definitive blossoming or definitive arrival, because, you know, he already won the Vuelta a España last year, but he's shown us things, we've seen things, haven't we, over the last few months that suggest that he might belong to a different category even from Roglic.
Yeah, I mean, today certainly highlighted that thought as well. I would still say, let's say if Roglic had lost 10 seconds less on a 19-kilometer time trial, it would have been within the normal sort of difference between those two, even if Roglic is the defending, you know, he's the Olympic champion. He will have to Roglify quite a lot of arrivals, a lot of finish, a lot of bonus seconds to basically scrape back what he lost today. And it puts down a marker for, you know, the time trial that's in the horizon, which is almost twice as long. So it's going to be an interesting race. And it's also the interesting dynamics in Remco getting the jersey this early, because clearly he doesn't want to hold on to that for 3 weeks. I don't think that's realistic. And it's a huge ask for any team and for any rider, really, even if the Giro is less stressful than the Tour. So it sets an initial marker of, you know, the race is still wide open. You know, if this initial time trial had been 10 kilometers, it would have been minuscule differences. But, you know, now we know the hierarchy. That was a few decent surprises also. In the second tier sort of favorites for the race.
I mean, there are different ways to sort of gauge Roglic's performance, aren't there? If you look, you know, if someone had said to you he's going to finish on the same time as Stefan Kung, you would say, okay, Roglic has ridden a great time trial. He's had a great start to the Giro. Similarly, you know, he took 15 seconds or 12 seconds off Geraint Thomas. So that's in the kind of that's more or less what you would expect from Primoz Roglic. But yeah, to lose 43 seconds or 46 seconds, I mean, I think back to Alicante last year in the Vuelta a España, which was a longer time trial, a flat time trial as well, and he lost a similar amount of time to Remco, and that was after Roglic had a bad preparation to the Vuelta a España, or a difficult preparation because of circumstances last year. As far as we know, and he said to me, we heard it earlier, that he feels he's in good form. As far as we know, his preparation's been good.
I think there's a couple of things that worth noting about that, especially after hearing his interview. I think he was happy, and I think he was genuinely happy, because he looked at his numbers. He also said to you that he hadn't seen yet the time differences. It must have been a disappointment to finish that far behind Evenepoel. But still, if he looked at his numbers and he was happy, and it confirmed what he'd seen in training. And don't forget that he's coming here relatively under-raced, but that's normal for him. And he knows, and I think we know, that the Giro will be decided in the last week in the big climbs, I think, at least. Not going to be decided on the time trials. But if you think back to Tirreno Adriatico, which opened with a time trial as well, he was very under impressive there, but still ended up pummeling everyone, big riders on the climbs, and we won like three stages there. So I think, you know, if he thinks his numbers are good, he can't be surprised that Evenepoel beats him. A little bit disappointing that it's not 10 seconds less, but we'll see. The interesting and beautiful thing about this Giro is that it gets really difficult very early. So by the time we get into the climbing stages later this week, we'll get a much clearer indication of whether he is under-raced or whether he's actually just timed it right.
Could there be something liberating in all this misfortune? Has it taken some pressure off him?
I think so. I think so, yeah. And also, the interesting thing about Roglic is, he's very, very good at shorter week-long races because he can really administer his ability to take seconds on the finish line. That's not how you win the Giro, and he's tried before where he spent an enormous amount of energy marking Nibali, say in 19, and he was sort of burned way too many matches in his quest for the pink jersey, and he's not here for that. And I don't think he's, I mean, it would have been nice with the pink jersey, but when you look at the decimated team that he's ended up with now because of various reasons we spoke about before, it wouldn't be a great thing for him to lead this race too early, and there's no chance he will, because there's actually few strong climbers in front of him right now.
What we're doing here is extrapolating from today, and we're talking about what it might mean. I mean, I have always on the podcast, I'm of the school that these time trials, these short time trials, today wasn't actually that short, 90 kilometers, but I think they matter. I think they're very revelatory. However, not everyone agrees with that. But on this subject, let's hear from a rider, Jack Haig, Bahrain Victorious leader here. He was 38th today, 136 down from Remco Evenepoel. Well, I asked him at the finish, or I spoke to him about how revealing today really was. And if it wasn't, why not?
The course is so much about staying in position. And you see that the average speed to the bottom of the climb, I think, is upwards of 55 kilometers an hour. And the faster we go, the more aerodynamics has to play. So that's why I think that, of course, you need to have the legs. And maybe Gunner would win regardless whether we did it on all road bikes with the same equipment, but definitely at these kind of speeds, the technology plays a big role. I'm not saying that we're behind, but I'm not saying that we're number one either. So I think you'll see, like in a lot of the time trial results this year, you see a cluster of teams kind of in the top 10, top 15. And I don't think that's just from legs. I think there is a little bit of technology to play there. But like I said, it's not the thing that determines the result, but it just helps a little bit.
It's a 19-kilometer time trial. We'll probably look at the results tonight and say that's quite revealing of form, but based on what you're saying, it might also be revealing of other things.
Yeah, I think, look, it will be a good indicator of form, but I think if we had maybe a more undulating time trial with like 48, 49 kilometers an hour would be more of an indication of form, but just because this is such a high average speed, you'll see who's got good legs, but you might not see people on lesser teams, maybe even the Pro Conti teams, that'll really show themselves in the mountains later, that don't have any time to develop a time trial position, but have amazing legs.
Brian, interesting point there from Jack Haig about how today's time trial particularly might have revealed other factors besides form. And we then started scanning the results, didn't we? And we looked at whether there were clusters of riders who perform well. Obviously, it's difficult to untangle this from the time trialing pedigree of the particular riders who have been picked by the teams for this Giro. However, Ineos, or Filippo Ganna was second. Ganna looked really disappointed to me in his interviews after the finish. Ganna was second. Theo Gegenhardt did a fantastic time trial, confirming what sensational form he's in. He was fourth, 40 seconds down. And then Thomas was ninth.
Don't forget about Almeida
seconds.
Either.
Well, then I was going to come on to them. UAE also, they had a cluster of riders. João Almeida he overperformed, I would say, almost more than anyone, although he's a really good time trialist. But to finish third in that company is a sensational result. 29 seconds down. McNulty, eighth, and actually seventh, Jay Vine, who I talked about in the preview. He's one of the most intriguing riders in this Giro for me. So there was a little cluster there. But the slightly curious thing about this is that Jumbo-Visma is the team of any team we associate them most with good equipment, sort of savoir-faire on that score, don't we? However, well, Roglic was their only rider today who had a sort of significant performance. I mean, Eduardo Affini, you would expect him to go well on a flat time trial, 19 kilometer time trial, okay, small climb at the end, but he was 25th, 126 down. What we don't know, and I only spoke to Roglic and Glog of the Jumbo-Visma riders, we don't know whether these guys were out there to...
I don't think they asked anyone but Roglic and maybe Affini to go full gas. I couldn't see any reason why any other rider on Jumbo-Visma would. I think Jack Haig's points are super interesting. And there's the obvious element that the faster they go, the more aerodynamics count. And with Remco pushing above 55 kilometers an hour, his aerodynamic setup must have been absolutely perfect. It's extremely fast, extremely fast. And I think technology just
was
keeps...
Was he wearing the special super snood?
Yes, it was. Yeah. He was. Yeah, and technology moves so fast in the bike industry. And even if you've had the fastest bike for a couple of years, if someone brings out new equipment that's even further developed, it will have a significant impact. Remco would have won anyways. But if he's on a super fast setup, or if UAE collectively are on a super fast setup, that could explain at least a handful of seconds.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I think I always get the impression that this is, as you would expect, a subject that the riders think about a lot more than we as journalists. And that's partly because, we can't, and certainly not we, because this is certainly not our forte, we can't be on top of every equipment change. And there's a lot of secrecy around this now, particularly on time trial days and other points of the season. Teams are pretty cagey about what sort of setups they're using. But, certainly like more and more over the last 3 or 4 years, I've noticed, particularly kind of off the record chats with riders, they've talked a lot about equipment. And it's something that's very much in their head in the same way that probably doping was 20 years ago. It's almost, I'm certainly not saying that Jack Haig is paranoid, but I think there is often this sort of nagging anxiety about other teams and other riders having better or faster equipment.
Well, I short anecdote in the when there was a team time trial at the World Championships, we lost. I worked for Orica Greenwich at the time. We lost the World Championship with 1 second, and Quickstep, who won it, they were on faster wheels, faster tires, significant aero advantage. I think that Orica would have won. Because 1 second, if you compare to the technological advances they would have had, if we would have been on equivalent equipment, the average watts of the riders would have been higher, and we could have won it by, 30 seconds maybe even, because it was a fairly long team time trial into Florence. So that's a very interesting element in that, and it's not, it's not great for Roglic to lie awake at night thinking about this, because there's a long time trial coming up at the end of the first week. So it's the end of the first part of the Giro. So this is an interesting element, and I'm not sure they can change it now. They have the setup that they have.
Just as well on Roglic and the setup he went with. I mean, a lot of people watching him today thought he was in a too big a gear. I'm not sure we heard it there. I don't think we did. He sort of skirted around that. Someone did put it to him, and he said, it's not the best for me. Kind of a opaque answer, difficult to know whether he himself thought that he'd overgeared. He didn't look as though he found his, certainly in the first part of the time trial. You talked about how he actually went well on the climb, but in the first part of the climb time trial, he looked as though he was struggling to find his rhythm a little bit.
Well, when you look at the how he came into this Giro, and you look at how Remco came into this Giro, they've both done a lot of altitude. Roglic more recently coming into this Giro, and I think the bulk of the work Roglic has done has been climbing, and coming down from altitude and straight into like such a high paced and such a fast time trial wouldn't be ideal. And when you think of Evenepoel, he rides road races like a time trial.
Yeah,
he basically, he says goodbye to the favorite group with 30, 40, sometimes even further away from the finish. So I think he will always be really strong, and he's super ready and he's super aero. I think Roglic's work coming into this Giro has focused not solely, but mainly on the climbing.
Yeah, well, it remains to be seen. We, of course, had an interview with Vasi Antastopoulos.
Would have been interesting to hear from Jumbo-Visma's coaches.
It would have been. Sudal Quickstep coach, who was with Remco in, where was he? He was in Tenerife as well, wasn't he? But he, of course, we heard that he went back to altitude after Liège, but he was very much focusing on his time trialing in that last block of training, I believe. just on Remco, you said there he's very aerodynamic. There was a piece, I mean, the as we expected, I fully expected to turn up at the press room today and for it to be teeming with Belgian journalists. Sure enough, it is. There are a lot of Belgian, of our Belgian colleagues here, and they are really squeezing the sponge for new angles on Remco. And apparently, I need to investigate this. I hope I haven't got this wrong, but I think there was a piece in Het Nieuwsblad today about how aerodynamic Remco's skin is. Not his skin suit, his skin. He has naturally, physiologically...
He's a fast face.
He's got a fast face. Yeah, that's... maybe even faster than pretty much Roglic. Just on Roglic as well. Roglic is...
He speaks faster too.
Yeah, Roglic's humour has been a feature of the last couple of years. It did sort of fail him this afternoon when he got back to the Jumbo-Visma camping car. And there was a tifoso, a fan, who I think was Italian, but he was speaking to Roglic in a sort of unintelligible Esperanto. And he was just shouting out, Froglic, Froglic. And Primo sort of looked at him quizzically. And then he said, Rana, Rana, which is the Italian word for frog. And then sort of burst out laughing at his own joke. And at this point, Roglic, who had been laughing for the last 2 minutes with everyone surrounding him, at this point, he sort of shot this guy a poker face. And yeah,
I like this.
It wasn't terribly funny.
I like this side of Roglic. I think we're getting to know him more and more.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2023 Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
The Giro d'Italia is off and running, and our coverage is once again sponsored by Science in Sport, the world leaders in sports nutrition. You can find everything you need to fuel your ride or your run or your sport, whatever it may be, at scienceinsport.com, because Science in Sport supply some of the biggest sports teams in the world, from the Milwaukee Bucks to the Manchester United football team, don't tell Daniel I said that, and the Ineos Grenadiers. I spoke to Ben Swift, one of the most experienced riders in the peloton, let alone the Ineos Grenadiers lineup at this Giro. It's his 15th year as a pro, and this is his fifth Giro d'Italia. He first rode it back in 2009, which was his debut season. And I asked him, what had he learned about nutrition in the course of his long career? What had changed in terms of not just the products, but also the nutrition strategy?
Okay, if we go through, let's say, strategy, you know, we were the first ones to do like the really like low carb stuff and using that as a strategy. And it's amazing to see what we've changed. Seeing now is like, it used to be all about the low carb. So low carb breakfast on the bike, post ride, then you'd fuel up in the evening. And then it kind of went through the phase of where you do low carb on the breakfast, low carb on the bike, high lunch, and then low carb in the evening. And now it's kind of gone full circle again, where it's just more about high carb everywhere to try and get like the energy in and stuff like that. So, and we've also seen the change in races. So we've had to like fuel for the races, because everything's just gone so much faster now and so much more intense. We're seeing the races opening up so much earlier. It's not really that slow burn anymore. So you've had to fuel for that. And then I think that kind of translates to the products that we're using. We're seeing much higher quality or quantity of carbohydrates in the drinks. You know, like I remember when the Beta Fuel first came out, it was kind of crazy to have 80 grams of carbs in one drink. It was kind of unheard of before. And now we're getting like the, you know, like the bake bars and like the Beta gels that have got 40 grams. So it's like, it's a massive hit in one small dose. And that's kind of, you know, like when I first turned pro, it was, you'd maybe have a bar or like one gel, which kind of would have 20 grams in it or something like that, you know? So to have almost like double, sometimes triple of that in one go is, it's a massive improvement now. And also like the quality of it is just so different now.
For the full range, go to scienceinsport.com.
You must be out of your goddamn mind. Joe Louis, the greatest boxer ever lived. I'll be with you boys in a minute. He was bad in Captain Clay. He bad in Sugar Ray. He bad in that. Who that? The new boy got. Mike Tyson. Look like a bulldog. He bad in him, too. He done whipped Mike Tyson's ass. He whipped all their asses.
What about Rocky Marciano?
Oh, there they go. There they go. Every time I start talking about boxing, a white man got to pull Rocky Marciano out their ass.
Well, Brian, what was that?
Well, that was a dialogue from one of the great movies from the 1980s, Coming to America, where these fellas in the barbershop are talking about one of the greatest, maybe potentially the greatest fighter of all time, Rocky Marciano.
Rocky Marciano, iconic Eddie Murphy film. Brian, where are we now? Why is this relevant to where we are now?
Because we are standing in front of a life-size bronze statue of Rocky Marciano. And very close to where we're going today for the time trial is actually the birthplace of his father.
Correct. We're in a place called Ripa Teatina. And as you say, his dad, who wasn't called Marciano, he was called Marchigiano. I'm not sure how the name got changed. Anyway, he emigrated like millions of Italians. He emigrated to the United States around about the turn of the century. And his son, Rocky Marciano, became, by some estimates, the greatest heavyweight boxer of all time. The only heavyweight boxer who ended his career with something like almost 50 fights undefeated.
Yeah, and he was also the shortest ever heavyweight champion.
Same height as you?
The exact same height as me. Carried a bit more of a bit more muscle, a bit more of a punch. I'm more sort of the dad bod these days. But yeah, what a fight and what an athlete.
And Brian, you're a bit of a sculpture connoisseur. How does this one rate? I'm just looking at it. It was installed 1990.
Well, I actually think it's a quite a beautiful statue. I think his face is a little bit less accentuated than his muscles. Actually, when you see it from behind, it's actually really well made. Quite small feet, but he was a quick one, wasn't he? And with a great reach also. Yep. Undefeated Rocky Marciano.
Brian, Abruzzo, the region we're in, very fertile as far as illustrious émigrés are concerned. A lot of people who ended up being famous in the United States in particular hailed, or their families hailed from Abruzzo. Dean Martin was born Dino Paul Crocetti, fully Italian name, only spoke Italian in the first years of his life. His family was from Montesilvano, Pescara, just down the road, just where we're going, in fact, for the time trial today. Michael Bublé, not someone we particularly are fans of on the Cycling Podcast.
Well,
but
it's not on the playlist, though.
Canadian singer, songwriter, actor, of course. His grandmother, Yolanda Moscone, was from Carufo in the province of L'Aquila in Abruzzo as well. And, well, we've mentioned Rocky Marciano, possibly the greatest boxer of all time or greatest heavyweight of all time. Probably the greatest motor racing driver or F1 driver of all time, Juan Manuel Fangio, or Fangio, if you pronounce it in alla italiana. His grandparents were from his grandfather was from Chieti, also just down the road. And his grandmother was also from Abruzzo, a different part of Abruzzo. So, as I say, lot of very famous emigres from Abruzzo.
Yeah, and you'd almost wonder why they would leave here, because this is a really beautiful place.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Well, Brian, that was us earlier today in Ripa Teatina. The race is going to go there tomorrow. We'll talk about that again in a minute. But we're very much enjoying our time in Abruzzo, aren't we? And not only because of the Pecorino.
No, I think it's a beautiful and potentially underestimated part of Italy. Basically, it has everything. High mountains, beautiful coastline, great food, fantastic cycling traditions. It's, if they want to do it as a way of highlighting the beauties of this area, they've certainly done a good job, and it'll be a really beautiful stage tomorrow as well.
And Brian, well, today was the Costa dei Trabocchi, these sort of fishermen's huts that dot the coast, that the race went up today. We've got a Trabocco on the label of the wine we're drinking. We ate in one a couple of years ago, and it was, you know, I don't eat seafood really, but it was a memorable experience, and the food was, by all accounts, according to everyone around the table who ate fish, it was excellent.
Yeah, I did that as well when the Giro went past in 2019, and I enjoyed it a lot. And it's quite an ingenious way of of fishing, really. And I was reading up on the background of these today because it was such a significant element of the stage, and they potentially dated back all the way to the Phoenicians. So it's a very, very old construction. And apparently, because they weren't that great farmers back then, they were trying to support themselves via fishing. And they weren't great navigators and great sailors either. So to avoid this, the cliffs of the coast and the tides and everything, they basically created these huts to be able to support themselves via fishing. And it's something that, you know, it's not for nothing that you see it on this label. It's sort of the symbol of this region, at least the coastal part of this region.
It's an interesting region, isn't it? Because we were also on the terrace yesterday afternoon. We were talking with our host here, Francesca, about Abruzzo. And the people from Abruzzo, it was clear, certainly talking to Francesca, they really consider this part of the south. And we've talked many times before on the podcast about this big north-south divide in Italy. And you know, there was a big political movement. There has been a big political movement for a long time. What's the word? It's kind of separatist, cessation.
Salvini was, when early in his career, former, I don't think he's a...
Lega Nord.
Yeah, and he wanted to do a clean cut separation.
There are people who would like the North and the South to be different countries because they're very different economically and in other ways as well. But Abruzzo is geographically, it's just south of the center line. And you and I were both saying to Francesca that
Not the south.
Well, yeah, it doesn't feel like the south. It feels like a relation of a cousin of Tuscany or Le Marche or Umbria. But she was saying, no, they feel very much like the south. And we were talking also about the fact that when Danilo Di Luca won the Giro d'Italia in 2007, he was hailed as the first ever rider from the south to win the Giro d'Italia, which in itself was quite extraordinary. It was 100 years of history and the first southern Italian rider. But she said that they feel their identity is very much southern. I said to her, which I don't think she really appreciated, that Abruzzo to me, if it is part of the south, it's like the Switzerland of the south.
That's not nice.
It's not a country that you appreciate as much as I do.
Judging from what she said, there's several elements to the north-south divide. And the way she spoke about it was that the mental outlook here is southern, right? So the way they don't take themselves career-wise, they don't kill themselves to go to work, they're quite sort of relaxed. And I sense that. But when you look at how, you know, this is one of the biggest wine-growing regions in Italy, probably the second biggest, and how meticulous they are, and this is a lot of work working these types of vineyards. Where we are now is biological, which is a lot more work than conventional farming. So they're quite serious about what they do, and you need to be quite busy and you need to be really on the ball to work that way, which is not usually what we think about southern Italy, you know.
It's not the stereotype, is it?
No, but it's more the mental outlook. And when you look at how they've been quite busy resurfacing as late as today, basically, the roads for the Giro tomorrow. So there's, you know, that's a very southern thing. Mm. Had it been up north, those roads would have been finished. You know, the paving would have been done by November last year.
It is an interesting region. I was reading a bit about it in the days before the Giro. It's the only southern region with no evidence of any Greek influences here. The Greeks made it everywhere in the south of Italy, but they didn't make it here. And that's one of the theories about that is because there's no real plain. It's quite a difficult place to attack from the coast. It's very, very mountainous. It's a sort of region that for a long time it was said that Italians... So their idea of it, their sort of mental image of it was a physical image. They could imagine the landscape, but they didn't really have any notion of a sort of other contributions to the national psyche. They didn't have a major newspaper for a long time, no major university for a long time. And also a huge number of Abruzzesi, people from this region, left for Rome in particular. Apparently there were more Abruzzesi in the 60s, there were more Abruzzesi, I don't know if this is the case today, in Rome than in the four biggest cities of Abruzzo.
This is a geographical element to this as well. It was funny, when I was on the train coming here, there was a father with two young children, and he was quizzing his kids about the Italian regions, so the 20 regions in Italy, and how they are obviously all connected. And he was quizzing them, and they couldn't really sort of by heart tell which region came after the other. And when you look at it, it's like, you know, Le Marche, Abruzzo, Molise, and we all know Molise, other than the joke about it not existing,
yeah,
it's deep south to me, at least. Mm. Molise is south. But I feel like when I'm in Le Marche, it feels like a little bit of world of its own. And Abruzzo and Le Marche, I can't distinguish them, mm, other than I know they're different.
Very mountainous, very beautiful.
Yeah, and they're different wine regions. They grow different grapes, mostly. But other than that...
You've used up so many wine tokens
you
tonight.
You opened it with that, excuse me. But they're, to me, a little bit indistinguishable. But as with anything in Italy, you couldn't tell someone from Abruzzo, are you really just, you know, Le Marche people? They would be quite offended by that. It would be the same if you told me that, yeah, you're Tuscan, so you might as well live in Livorno. Never.
Brian, enough of us droning on about Italian geography. We've had a postcard from us. Let's have a postcard from someone else. Our good friend, Lucky Larry Warbus, the Motown maestro who is riding this Giro d'Italia.
Larenzando, a postcard from Italy with Larry Warbus.
Well, Larry, you're underway. You're rolling. You're rocking and rolling. How was that?
Yeah, good. I tried not to rock and roll. I tried to be super stable on the TT bike. Yeah, I think it was okay. At first, I wasn't planning on going full gas, but then the team said they wanted my checkpoints for Aurelian at the end, so I said, well, shit, okay.
You were used by the team for the benefit of someone else.
I guess that's what they pay me for, so...
How are you feeling generally coming into the race? I mean, how have you felt about the last couple of weeks, the prep?
Well... My prep kind of sucked, but I actually feel quite good, all things considered. So,
what did it suck?
Well, just like I would have liked to do a solid altitude camp, like a straight block, you know, like 3 weeks or something straight at altitude. But like I think we mentioned in a few episodes, is like I had to go do Basque Country, and then, you know, the Ardennes were always planned. So kind of came down, went back up, came down, went back up. So hasn't exactly been the most... It's been a rock and roll preparation, so not as stable as I would have liked, but actually I feel really good, so I hope I'll be able to do something.
We expect big things. You're the first, you're not a guest anymore, you're a host. Yeah. You're the first cycling podcast host to ever do the Giro d'Italia, and we're expecting cultural insights from you most days.
Okay, that sounds good. You know, it's funny because I was telling my teammate today that I was looking at the cycling podcast Instagram, and I was like, damn, that looks like that looks fun, you know? I was like, oh, there, you know... Eating good food, drinking good wine, staying at nice places, and, you know, meanwhile we're in some 1976 era hotel that hasn't been updated since 1976, so, but it's okay, you know, at least it's on the sea, it has a nice view.
Much as I'd like to be a cycling megastar, I wouldn't swap places with you, Larry.
Yeah, I mean, I thought, you know, maybe in a few years I can come join you guys on the other side.
Cheers, Larry.
Yeah.
La tappa di domani e la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Brian, let's start with yesterday's dinner. What did we have? I mean, it wasn't sort of Barone, usual Barone standards. It was a fairly humble eatery, wasn't it? Just down the road, down the valley from where we're staying. And what did I have? I had Sagne, which was, it's kind of like tagliatelle gone wrong. And Sagne, and you can probably imagine there's some relation to lasagne. And what it actually is what, if you can imagine, fettuccine or tagliatelle cut by, yeah, someone who's a little bit scissor happy. So they're very short. So I had those with ceci, with chickpeas, and it's a soup, really. You get something similar in Tuscany. And I committed a bit of a cardinal sin yesterday because I was very hungry because I hadn't really eaten all day. So I had two primi piatti, two sort of starters or pasta dishes. I had lasagne, and then I had ravioli, which was, it had the ricotta and spinach inside, and was a kind of saffron sauce. You had a steak.
I had a steak and a salad.
But do we need to dwell too much more on yesterday's?
No,
it wasn't
no.
that much of a gastronomic extravaganza, was it?
And should, as we spoke on? About, we, I'm going to overcompensate tonight based on yesterday's misbehaves.
Eek. The my wallet is wincing. Anyway, Brian, tomorrow's stage.
Yeah, tomorrow's stage, the first road stage of the 2023 Giro. Quite a long one, 202 kilometers. Takes us from Teramo to San Salvo. It's not pancake flat. There are a few climbs, smaller climbs in the beginning, and then there's two categorized climbs in the middle and the last part. It's not an easy finish in the technically. There's a few corners and the last sort of kilometer and a half, and but then the last kilometer is one straight line. This is most likely going to be one of the obvious, and I think quite few, sprint stages of this Giro.
Brian, tomorrow we said we're in Abruzzo. We're going to have finished tonight by talking about one of, well, probably the most famous Abruzzese. We heard about Rocky Marciano, his Abruzzese roots. He would be the most, maybe him or Dean Martin would be the most famous Abruzzese in the United States. But if you speak to an Italian person, the most famous Abruzzese is probably Gabriele D'Annunzio, a sort of titan of the Italian literary scene, public life, around about the start of the 20th century. But it's one of those names that if you study Italian, if you spend a lot of time in Italy, you hear an awful lot about. And I must confess, I always heard that name, knew that, you know, he'd written books and poems and this and that, but didn't really know too much about him. But tomorrow we are skirting his birthplace, Pescara. Brian, should we say buonasera to the listeners and, well, hear from our sort of cultural guru on the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia, that's John Foote, who is the author of lots of books about modern Italy, also about cycling, Pedalare. His most recent book is called Blood and Power, The Rise and Fall of Italian Fascism. And, well, there is a link between Gabriele D'Annunzio and fascism. So let's hear about that from John. And Brian, we'll be back tomorrow around about the same time. Where will we be this time tomorrow?
I think we'll be in Vasto.
Correct. I think. I hope. Eek. Here's John Foote.
So he was this incredible figure, really. I mean, there's an amazing, if anyone wants to read about him, there's this book called The Pike, which I would highly recommend by Lucy Hughes Haller, which is also a fantastic read. He's a sort of actually quite repulsive figure in many ways, but an extraordinary kind of ahead of his time kind of guy, a poet, filmmaker, soldier. He was everything at once, and kind of novelist, sort of famous lover. And I suppose his kind of contribution to history that's most important is that he kind of invents fascism. He's a kind of spin doctor of fascism. Most of the slogans of fascism are invented by him. He's a great sloganeer. And in 1919, he takes a kind of ragbag army of like volunteers, and he invades a place called Fiume, which is today in Croatia, was kind of contested territory after the First World War. And he takes control of it and kind of runs it as a crazy little dictatorship, with all kinds of artists and poets turning up. And I mean, it's mad. It's like a sort of Woodstock crossed with a fascist state. I mean, it's really weird. And a lot of the things that happen there are then transmitted into fascism. So with it, you don't really get fascism without D'Annunzio. But he never really joins fascism. He kind of contributes to it, but he never becomes part of the regime, never joins parliament properly. So he's kind of, that's why there are streets named after him. One of the most bizarre places to go in the world is the Vittoriale, which is placed up on top of the hill above Lake Garda, where he lived for years. The most kind of kitsch, I don't know if you've ever been there, Daniel, but it's absolutely mad. I mean, it's the garden's got like biplanes in it, boats dug into the side of the hillside. His house is the most kind of grotesquely kitsch place you've ever seen in your life. Even in the First World War, you look at he lost an eye. He went on hundreds of like crazy plane missions. There's this mad thing where he goes on a kind of submarine and he threw leaflets over Vienna. It's all kind of crazy stuff and sort of often militarily dubious. But, you know, it's sort of hard to ignore. And kind of, I don't think fascism would have happened without him. Also, because he was a sort of media savvy kind of guy, advertising, you know, gave fascism all its kind of advertising slogans, which they then just stole, even the black shirts and things like that. So it's a fascinating figure. Pescara kind of claims him. I don't think he was that interested in Pescara, to be honest, but they kind of claim him as their son, as lots of places do in Italy, in terms of famous people born there who didn't spend much time there. But he was a really interesting and crucial personality for 20th century Italy.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.